It's so nice to see George up here leading songs. Could have been me. I had to lead songs in Youngstown this morning. And, oh, my, how my timing has gotten rusty. It brings to mind a prayer request. A Lily guy injured her back this week, and that's why Jimmy was home helping, looking after her and the kids. So that's how I ended up leading songs. But please remember her as well. We had a nice gathering. It was a little on the shy side this time, but even so, a very enthusiastic group up in Youngstown. All right. Did you ever have the feeling that someone is watching you? You know, we had years ago, we lived in Roseburg, Oregon. Man, it was a pastor, Roseburg and Coos Bay. Coos Bay was straight west of Roseburg, about 90-some miles, obviously on the coast. It was the only deep water bay America has between Seattle and San Francisco, is Coos Bay. And it's a town of about 30,000. But in the Roseburg church, we had, or in the Roseburg area where we lived inland, this is when Rush Limbaugh was really starting to become famous as a talk show or a radio talk guy. And there was a young fellow in the Roseburg area that was trying to imitate his style and had his own program. And it was only on like three times a week and only an hour. And he did his best. You know, he was tried to put on the same voice. That's not a good sign. You develop your own voice. But one of the things that I did enjoy about the wannabe is he had a good sign-off line. And the sign-off line is, just because you're not paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you. Have you ever had the feeling you're being watched, you know, and you aren't sure, but you just got that eerie feeling? I had that one time. This goes back now further to our early years in as ministerial trainee out in Montana, western Montana. And most of the men in the church hunted elk, so obviously I hunted, so we went elk hunting with them in 1975. First day out, the group of us had three elk down. I didn't get any of them, but they did. Three elk down, and by the end of the day, though, we packed out a half of that, one of the elk, the smallest one. The next day we went back with a couple of other friends there in the congregation, and on the way in to find the two and a half that we left, a big bull stood up, and he laid right back down again. And so while they were dressing that animal out, it was my job to take the rifle that belonged to the fellow that shot the elk, and I'd never shot his gun before, I was totally unfamiliar with it, and go and find the best path down to where these cows were, two cow elk. We could shoot cows, calves, or bulls in that unit, and then see what would be the best route for packing them out when we were getting a horse in there to pack them out. So I went over there and I found them finally. It took a little while, and my bearings are not always straight when I get back in the woods. This was deep forest, tall trees. You did have some sun coming through, but there were big tall trees and some burnt off stumps. And I walked up to the first elk I found, and I thought, something's wrong with that elk. You know, I spotted its head, and then I'm walking up there, and I thought, it's not all there. An entire hindquarter had been hauled off, bones and all. The whole hindquarter was gone. Now, this is an animal that weighed on the hoof 600-700 pounds. And I thought, and what's wrong with the leg that's laying there? It took me a few seconds to realize, hold it, that's just the bone. So they ate a hindquarter, and then they tore the other one off and hauled it away. And I said, what's all this brush scratched on top of it? I know what this is. This is grizzly bear territory. They'll claim the kill, you see. And they usually urinate on it, so that's explained the perfume odor that was in that particular clearing. I thought, well, this isn't good. We've got grizzlies eating our elk. So then I went to find the other cow, the other one that we had down tagged. She had not been eaten, which was good, but she had been claimed, which was bad. And they got them, as it turned out. So then I hiked back and told the one of the other men, the man who was dressing out the bull elk that we now had, I said, told him what happened. And so we were trying to make plans. We're going to pack the bull down to the trail because it was much closer than the others were. And then we would come back and start to pack them out. And as the day wore on and the horse didn't like having hindquarters of elk or shoulders tied to his saddle, and so he got a little skittish. So it was a rodeo and an elk hunt and a really spooky event, because while I was still back down there, as soon as I realized what had happened, I started looking around in the woods. Grizzly bears can sprint faster than a racehorse for a short distance, and I mean really fast, and they've got traction, you know, none of this slipping stuff. They've got 4-inch claws that dig into the ground when they come. So I was scoping every burnt stump that I could see. Anything that resembled remotely a grizzly bear, I was checking with the scope of the rifle. So then the other fellow said, well, you better go and get that half of the calf elk, the shoulders or the hindquarters, and pack that out. And we're going to do this other stuff. So toward the end of the day, it was too late to pack up the cows. We'd get them the next day. I went back to the kill site and double-checked those two cows. And for sure, that wasn't my imagination. And you know that I checked my back trail constantly as I walked through there. You just had this feeling that it's a very hungry, cantankerous bear. And had I known it was a sow with cubs, that would have even been worse, because that's what it was. We got a snowstorm. And the following week, they were back in to try to recover some of them. There wasn't any to recover. A sow with three cubs pretty much eats everything. So I picked up the hindquarters, put it on my backpack, and instead of side-hilling around, I went down in the canyon and up the other side. And we were on a ridge right at the edge of a wilderness area where the animals were. And I would come up the canyon side, and then there was the ridge line dipped way down here, sort of a little pass, and the trucks were parked there. But it went up like this, and then it came to a hump like that, and then it dropped back down. And guess where I started hiking? Right up the back of the hump. I couldn't tell. I was in nasty thick forest, constantly checking my back trail, having this, you know, back, the hairs on the back of your neck sort of raising up, because you think there's got to be a bear behind me. I check this way, I check that way. It really slows your hiking when you got to do that all the time. Finally, I started to get hypothermia. The rain came; it was coming down. It was cold rain that would turn to snow the next night. And then we had a whole other story out of that elk hunt I could tell you sometime. But I got worse and worse with hypothermia, to where I was starting to shiver uncontrollably. I thought, okay, it's time to lay this load on a tree and just get out of here before I, you know, get too far into the shakes from hypothermia, because I was soaked, didn't have rain gear, you know, all those things you weren't prepared for and should have thought about and have thought about since. So all the time I'm climbing and dealing with the hypothermia, I'm looking back over my shoulder this way, back that way, to make sure there's no bear following me. And I finally unloaded the hindquarters onto a broken over tree to retrieve later. We never could find it. We went right through there. I found trees that were exactly like the tree that I put it on, so it got it too, as was our reckoning. We spent 2 hours combing that part of the ridge looking for it. I went up and over the hump and then down to the trail and down to the truck. It was an eerie experience to be out there with big animals that eat elk, eat half of an elk at a sitting, and realize that you don't weigh what a half an elk weighs. And it just felt like you're being watched. You ever felt like that? Felt like you're being watched and you aren't sure what it is? Well, if you don't, or if you do, it's because you are being watched by an unearthly power that sees everything you do and reads your minds. Of course, now you know who I'm talking about. But who are the watchers? The Bible talks about watchers. Not about those being watched as much as it talks about watchers. Who are the watchers? That's the title for the sermon. Who are the watchers? Let's go to Daniel chapter 4, and I'll show you the most enigmatic of our watchers. And then we'll analyze those a little bit. Daniel chapter 4. Here we go. Daniel worked for Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, back in the day. And that was quite a ways back in the day. Daniel and his three friends, who you usually know as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, which were Babylonian names. They actually had three Hebrew names. Each of them had a Hebrew name. They didn't have three, but they each had one. Before they were taken captive by the Babylonians, they were known as Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. Daniel had a Babylonian name. Daniel was his Hebrew name, but Daniel's Babylonian name is Belshazzar, as we'll see in a minute, in Daniel chapter 4. Daniel and his friends had not been taken when Jerusalem fell. Jerusalem fell in 586 B.C., but Daniel wasn't there. He was already in captivity, he and his and the three fellows that were with him. They all worked together. The reason was is that the Babylonians had conquered the kingdom of Judah itself, and then they would conquer it, and they would go through and strip out the gold off the temple or wherever else, get a king's ransom, an appropriate king's ransom to have make it a profitable foray that far away. And then, on top of that, they would take the best and the brightest out of the population. And they did that about three times. So they pretty well combed the house of Judah from its finest thinkers, with the exception of one. That was Jeremiah. But Jeremiah was usually in trouble with the king. And so, he was, when Jerusalem fell, Jeremiah was in a pit in the palace of the king of Judah. The pit was actually a cistern. It was a natural limestone cistern. The strata up where the promised land is located is got a natural limestone base to it down underneath. And that causes, based on the proclivities of limestone, it forms caverns. Sometimes those are used as cisterns where they store water from the rainy season so that they have it for the dry season, for drinking water and that sort of thing in homes and palaces. And when Jerusalem fell, Jeremiah was up to his armpits in the calcium slime, because the water leaches calcium out of the limestone, and then that becomes a thick mud at the bottom of the cistern over the years. And he was dropped down into that because the king didn't like him very much, because he kept saying but things were going to come apart and the king was going to go into captivity and that kind of thing. Thankfully, when the Babylonians broke through, then one of the king's slaves from Africa, Abel Bet-Merodach, I think is his name. I haven't looked it up recently, but I love the story. He organized a group of men, and they got some kind of cord that they fashioned and lowered that down and lifted Jeremiah out of that pit. So that Jeremiah was there during all that time. But Daniel and his friends were gone when Jerusalem fell, and that's why they were there serving Nebuchadnezzar at that time. So we come to chapter 4. Let's read the first few verses and set up the situation and find out about these watchers. Nebuchadnezzar the king, and this chapter is a chapter written by Nebuchadnezzar. This is an official document that Daniel included into his book, essentially quoting, historical documents of the time. To all peoples and nations and languages that dwell in all the earth. Now, Nebuchadnezzar didn't rule all the earth, but he ruled a fair share of it in that part of the world. Peace be multiplied to you. I thought it could be good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. Now, this is not a reference to some pagan god. There are plenty of those in this book because the Babylonians were tremendous pagans. This is speaking of the true God, as you'll see. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion from generation to generation. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in my house, now he tells his story, and flourishing in my palace when I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts in my bed and the visions of my head troubled me. Therefore I issued a decree to bring all the wise men of Babylon before me, that they might make known the interpretation of the dream. The magicians, astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers came in. Now, those are actually four categories of wise men. Daniel was in charge, of, as near as we can tell, of the ones called the magicians, except that's not your sleight-of-hand magicians of today. These are actually the magi. is where we get the word magician. The magi were, if they were pagan, they were pagan, but if they weren't pagan, then like Daniel and his friends would have been among them because they were wise. They were great counselors. And God, of course, magnified their abilities. So Daniel was a part of that, he being the chief of the magicians, or the magi, as they would have been known. But they did not make known to me the interpretation. None of the others could do it. They couldn't explain his vision. But at last Daniel came before me. His name is Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. See, when they got the Hebrews came in and served in the king's service, they ended up with a Babylonian name, which is what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are, Babylonian names. In him is the spirit of the holy God. This is recognized by Nebuchadnezzar. When you put the story of chapter 2 with the vision of the great image that Nebuchadnezzar saw, but he couldn't remember his dream, so he wanted the wise men to come and tell him what his dream was and interpret it. And they said, you tell us what the dream is and we'll interpret it. He said, no, you tell me what the dream is and then you interpret it. And then since they wouldn't do that, because they couldn't, then he was going to kill them. That's another story. It's a great story, too, and it's another piece of history. It's not just a story. It's a piece of history, and so is chapter 4. So he's chief of the musicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy God is in you, and no secret troubles you. Explain to me the visions of my dream and what I have seen and its interpretation. These were the visions of my head while I was on my bed. So now Nebuchadnezzar explains what he saw and why it was so troubling. I was looking, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. And the tree grew, and it became strong, and its height reached to the heavens. Just gigantic tree. And it could be seen on all ends of the earth. Its leaves were lovely, its fruit abundant, and it had food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it. The birds of the heavens dwelt in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. Incredible tree. When you read the interpretation, that was Nebuchadnezzar. He was this great, powerful leader, this great tree. Yeah, many people depended upon him for their food, sustenance, and all kinds of other things, because he ran the place, at least around the Babylonian Empire. And then I saw in my visions while on my bed, and there was a watcher. You know, not necessarily like a grizzly bear who's watching you move through the trees and trying to decide if he's hungry enough or if he's had enough to eat already. You know, you don't mess with grizzly bears. Black bears, sometimes you can get away with them, but not always. You never trust them. I've got another story about a grizzly bear, but I won't share it today. It's a really good one, too. There was this watcher, a holy one. Okay, so it's not an evil watcher, it's a holy watcher. Coming down from heaven, and he cried aloud, and he said this: chop down the tree, this great tree that Nebuchadnezzar saw. Cut off its branches, strip off its leaves, scatter its fruit, lest the beasts get out from under it, and the birds from its branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump and the roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze. In the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him, now we just shifted from the tree to a personal pronoun of him. Notice that shift? Let him graze with the beast of on the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from that of a man, and let him be given the heart of a beast, and let seven times pass over him. Now, if you read your Bible story written by Basil Wolverton, he illustrated this story, and he explained it all remarkably well. I don't know if you still have your copies of those, the Bible stories, whether you got the color copy that we got at the feast back in the 90s or the late 80s. I think it was the late 80s. Or the black and white version that they originally were. Keep them because they're extremely valuable collector's item. Basil Wolverton is a very famous artist. You know, we think of him as drawing pictures for the Bible story. Everybody else in the world thinks of him as one of the weirdest Mad Magazine cartoonists that ever drew breath. Weird in a good way, but that's actually where he is. He was an artist for Mad Magazine. And whenever Mad Magazine has one of its anniversary issues, and you happen to see it, look for the Basil Wolverton section. Almost always there's one there. They have half a dozen of his hilarious, exaggerated cartoons in it. Well, whatever the case, here we are with Nebuchadnezzar, and you know the pictures that you would have seen in that explains that the tree, Nebuchadnezzar was the tree, and he was getting too big for his britches in the sense of exalting himself. And so what God did is he drove him insane. And so he was no more understanding than an animal. And he lived in some massive courtyard in the confines of the palace, out in the open, and he slept in the grass, just like it says. He ate grass like the animals, and he was crazy for 7 years. And Mr. Wolverton, made the wise estimation that it would have been Daniel who would have been looking after him, because he was the one that understood the vision. And after 7 years, he got his mind back, just like that. It's a very interesting circumstance, but that's the overall story. We're getting back to what we were doing here. But the decision is by, in verse 17, by the decree of the watchers and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever he will and sets over it the lowest of men at times. So the watchers are mentioned in verse 13 and verse 17. Who are the watchers? Well, we need to look at, we can analyze that, but we could probably guesstimate angels, which is the actual answer. Let's go to Psalm 103, because now we want to know, well, do angels watch over us? Yes, they do. That's a part of their job. And here are several verses now that explain that. Psalm 103, verses 20 to 22. 20 to 22. Bless the Eternal, this is verse 20 of chapter or of Psalm 103. Bless the Eternal, you his angels, who excel in strength, who do his word, do God's word, heeding the voice of his word. Bless the Eternal, all you his hosts, you ministers of his, who do his pleasure. So if God sends the angels to look after human beings like us sometimes, they do it. And if that would have been there, he sends them to watch, they watch. We'll analyze how maybe they do the watching in a little bit. Bless the Eternal, all his works and all his places of his dominion. And then going back further in the Psalms to Psalm 34, is another example that where it doesn't speak of angels directly as being watchers, but it describes what they do, which requires watching. Psalm 34 and verse 7. Now, this is a very interesting psalm. You have to go back. I mean, by the way, you want to do a good Bible study sometime, you just start searching through the psalms till you find one that has a story in the superscription. The superscription is just above where verse 1 is, and it's usually printed in a smaller typeface. Look, notice this one. A psalm of David when he pretended madness before Abimelech, who drove him away and he departed. So this was when he was trying to escape from Saul's henchmen at one point, that David went to live with this Gentile king named Abimelech, live in his town or his city, and this is the story of it. Then you go back into 1 and 2 Samuel till you find that place, and you read the story, and then you come back and read his psalm, and you can see why he wrote the psalm. But we're going to pick from the psalm something very valuable here. It's in verse 7, as I said. The angel of the Eternal, or of the Lord, encamps all around those who fear him and delivers them. And you know, I got to thinking about that, climbing out of that canyon with carrying, you know, all these elk steaks on my back, so to speak, or any of the times I was over by the other ones, I started asking God to be sure that that angel was on duty and close by, you know, and packing the appropriate heat. Of course, they already have it. They don't have to pack it, just in case it was needed. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him, and he delivers them. So the angel is encamped around somebody, looking completely the other way, right? Now, when they're encamped around somebody, they're watching. They're watching whomever God has sent them to watch and look after. Let's go back to Hebrews chapter 1. So we understand who are the watchers in this case. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 13. But to which of the angels has he ever said, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool? He said that, of course, to Christ. But he doesn't say it to the angels. That's not their destiny. Are they not, verse 14, are they not all ministering spirits or serving spirits? To minister is to serve. Ministering spirits sent forth to minister for those who will inherit salvation. We are made a little lower than the angels as human beings. But when we're resurrected into the kingdom of God, we will be existing at a higher level than the angels. We'll be existing at the plane of existence where God the Father and Christ are, the family of God. So the angels are ministering or serving spirits. Now, do they do that with their eyes closed? No. They pay attention to what God wants them to do. So they're watching. Now, how well can they watch? Well, let's go to Ezekiel 1 and surmise what we can from that. And I say surmise what we can, see what I mean. It is indeed wonderful and exciting, but we have to wait until we are resurrected to fully comprehend it. So here's Ezekiel. Ezekiel, as I said, was taken into captivity in one of the times, either at the time Daniel and the other fellows were taken, or another time that he was taken. And he was then dumped off, shall we say, by the Babylonian authorities about 60 miles south of Babylon and about 1,000 miles by the roads from Israel, and he never got back. So everything that Ezekiel writes, and he cross-references very specifically his timing throughout the book, everything that he writes about Israel and everything is either from memory of the past or from direct inspiration from God. He never got to go back. That's important, because we're going to come back and see another part of Ezekiel before we get to the end of the sermon. All right, Ezekiel 1, verse 4, and I looked, and behold, a whirlwind was coming out of the north, and a great cloud with raging fire engulfing itself, and brightness was all around it, and radiating out of its midst like the color of amber, and out of the midst of a fire. And also from within came the likeness. So you got this great cloud of fire folding and engulfing itself back and forth. You know, I don't know what that would exactly look like. But it would be pretty impressive. I saw a cloud do that, something like that, but it was lightning. That was the fire in it. This was years ago in South Dakota. It was just a big old cloud that must have been, I don't know, a couple miles long. Maybe a mile wide, I don't know how high, half mile or a little bit more high. And it was just drifting across the prairie in the night. And it had lightning jumping back and forth in the cloud. It wasn't sending it out anywhere. It was just lightning coming back and forth through the cloud, rumbling away like an old school bus rattling down a gravel road. Except that it didn't carry any storm. There was no rain. The moon was out, the stars were out, and then you had this cloud drifting by. You know, lightning, and just there wasn't any time that it didn't have two or three bolts visible in one spot or another. One of those cool weather things you get to see once in a while. Maybe that was like this, except when the cherubim come, you know they're arriving. That's what we just described. These are cherubim, or cherubs, if you will. The CH is pronounced as a K, not a CH, and they aren't little fat babies with rosy cheeks and tiny wings. Not by any stretch, as you're going to see. Radiating out of its mist, color of amber in midst of the fire. And verse 5, from within it came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. Each had the likeness of a man. But each one had four faces. That's like Mount Rushmore, right? No, it's not, because they all face the same way. These four faces, there's one here, there's one back there, there's one off to the left and one off to the right, or the right or the left, whichever it was which. Their legs were straight. Okay, well, that's good. Straight legs, I comprehend that. But the soles of their feet were like the soles of calves' feet. They have hooves. Well, that's different. They sparkled like the color of burnished bronze. You try to imagine this in your mind. The hands of a man were under their wings. So they must have had arms and they had hands that they did things with. And they had wings as well. And each of the four had faces and wings. In verse 9, their wings touched one another. I'm presuming that, does that mean that one cherubim's wing touched the next cherubim's wings, or did it that the wings of a cherubim touched the other wings on the same cherubim? That's not 100% clear. The creatures did not turn as they went, but each one went straight forward. None of this swooping and diving and curving around. No. Why? How could they do that? You've got to be able to see where you're going, so you go. And I said, exactly. But what if you want to go to the left? You don't use this face, you use that face. And you just go. Never have to turn around. You want to go backwards? Not a problem. There's a face back there. And there's one over here. And I will read about those faces. We're coming up on that. And this is the likeness of their faces in verse 10. Each had the face of a man. Each of the four had the face of a lion on the right side. Each of the four had the face of an ox on the left side. And each of the four had the face of an eagle. So you got the man apparently in front. And then you had the lion and the ox and the eagle. The eagle was back behind. So they had four faces. And you think, well, where have I heard that before? Well, when Moses took the Israelites out of Egypt, and they built the tabernacle, and they built the Ark of the Covenant, and then they built the compound that went around the tabernacle, which was a portable temple is what it was, the tabernacle was. And when they would camp, then they would set it all up. The Levites carried all that stuff, and they'd set it all up. And then everybody would camp, all the tribes would camp in specific places. Now, the opening of the tabernacle was always facing east. And so the opening of the courtyard was always facing east. And east of the tabernacle was the tribe of Judah. It was parked right there, right outside there, right around the whole the compound of the of the tabernacle, around its outer layer. That was where the tribe of Levi was in a ring. But then immediately east, going out past the Levites, was Judah, with two tribes as wings off of that. Then, see, Judah was the lion. That was the symbol of Judah, was the lion. So you had the lion, and then you had, at the other side, you had the ox. So to the west of the temple was the tribe that had an ox for its symbol, Ephraim. So the tribe of Joseph was out there. You had Ephraim and Manasseh. Were parked out there, plus another tribe. And then you had the face of a man, and that was the symbol of Reuben. So Reuben was the face of the man and had two other tribes parked just past him, or past them, rather, off to one side and off to the other. And then you had the face of the eagle. That was Dan. That was Dan's symbol. And then there were two tribes parked out by Dan to the north. So that's, here we have the face of the cherubim who serve at the throne of God. And the way their faces are positioned is how the tribes parked around the temple of God. You know, there's a unity of artistic beauty and purpose in the way God does things. And that certainly is indicative of it. Now, so we have the face of a man, each of the four had the face of a lion, each of the four had the face of an ox, each on the left side, and each of the four had the face of an eagle. These thus were their faces, their wings stretched upward, two wings of each touched one another, and two covered their bodies. So they had four wings. Now these are different than the angels that Isaiah saw, and I think it's chapter 6 of Isaiah, but don't quote me on the chapter. They had six wings. They were called seraphim. And technically, they were seraphs. Remember that when I say the im behind cherubim or seraphim, that means the plural version of the word in Hebrew. Instead of writing S or ES afterwards, they would put an IM. That's their way of making a plural. So, for instance, parked out there in the parking lot are Karim. Not just cars, they're Karim, if the car was a Hebrew word. So it gives you the idea of it. So that's why you read of cherubim and seraphim and the im. It's just a plural form of the word. Where was I? I'll jump into 12. And they each went straight forward. This is good. Verse 12. Each one went straight forward. They went wherever the Spirit wanted them to go. They did not turn as they went. They didn't need to. I need to go that way. So if it's the man facing that way, zoom. We go on the face of the man using his eyes. But if we want to go off to one side, you either use the lion or the ox, and you go off that direction. You don't have to turn because you've already got a face aimed that direction. So it's, again, it's amazing just to try to imagine these things, and that kind of lifts us above our mundane everyday lives that we read what God says about the angels that serve at his throne, because it is the cherubim. Remember, two of the leading cherubim serve at the throne of God all the time. And it is there that they have their long wings, they have big wings that overstretch the throne of God. Now that was symbolized on the top of the Ark of the Covenant and the covering, because there was a symbol of, or a car, the only, it was the only statuary of something in heaven that God sanctioned. Because all the way, any other use of trying to imitate something in heaven is called idolatry. But when God sanctions it, it's not. So the Ark of the Covenant with the mercy seat was the symbol of God's throne. It is the mercy seat. That's where we go to seek mercy. And to one side and the other were statues of cherubim with their wings overstretching the throne. That was the covering of the Ark of the Covenant. And then in the temple, in Solomon's day when they built the temple, then the Ark of the Covenant was kept at the back in the most holy part of the temple, the rear room, so it would be the westernmost room. And then there were larger statues of cherubim that were installed in that part of the temple itself, and you could see the back of the wing beyond the edges of the tapestry that formed the wall, as it were, between the holy place and the most holy place. So again, God used that symbolism, and we're getting a picture of it in the vision that Ezekiel had. And as for the likeness of the living creature, verse 13, their appearance was burning coals of fire, like the appearance of torches going back and forth among the living creatures. The fire was bright, and out of the fire went lightning. So you got bright fire and then lightning jumping out of that. That's got to be amazing. And the living creatures ran back and forth in appearance like the flash of lightning. Shoo, shoo. You imagine that. We don't do that. Let's see, I need to go to the kitchen and get a cup of coffee. All right, start the rocking chair rocking, get enough momentum. I wish they didn't have such mushy upholstery in these recliners. All right, launch. You stagger to your feet, and you wander back to the kitchen, and what was I back here for? Got to go through so many launch sequences, you forget that you were after coffee. Now, they just zoom, 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 zoom. Now, we'll get used to that after the resurrection. And we'll do a little zoom in ourselves, I'm sure we will. But we'll be used to the angels and that, and it'll be amazing. But it's as a little picture of looking at the watchers. We're going to get to the watching part again in a minute. All right, where was I? Ah, right. The appearance of the wheels and their work was like the color of beryl in verse 16. And all four had the same likeness. So they looked very similar, looked like each other. And the appearance of their workings was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. So their workings. What was their workings, and how is it a wheel in a wheel? Is it a wheel like you got a wheel here and then a little wheel in the side? No, it's a wheel like this and a wheel like this. And they're the same size, apparently. So you think, well, that's a wheel? Yeah, you can go this way or it can go that way. Oh, just a minute. They had faces so they could do that when they fly. Okay, we get the idea of the wheel. We're going to talk about the wheel. Now, bear in mind, when it goes to watching, I think I mentioned this already, with the four faces, you had eight eyes. So the cherubim are always watching. they are among the, they may have been a cherubim that Daniel was hearing about, that were watching, because they could watch behind, forward, and off to either side. They were always watching. And why would they be watching if they're angels? Why are they always watching things? They are watching because they're ready to immediately go and do the will of God, whatever it is. These are holy angels. These aren't demons. These are men. These are angels who have shown their choice. And they are faithful to God, faithful as we intend and desire to be faithful as well. And their working was like a wheel in the middle of a wheel. In verse 17, when they moved, they went toward any one of four directions. They did not turn when they went. So there wasn't any of this swooping around like our sports cars do today. They have to go around like this and around like that. They just went, boom, and they want to go that way, go that way. Back this way, back that way. None of this turning business. You know, we have to turn. You know, we've always had to turn, ever since we got wheels on the ground. And the turning is as tight as the car or the wagon or the truck is able to turn. You have your what we call a turning radius. They didn't have turning radiuses. They just went this way or they went that way, whichever God called for. And as for the four directions, and they did not turn aside as they went. And as for their rims, the rims of these wheels that were within them, they were so high that they were awesome. And their rims were, get this, their rims were full of eyes. Now, if these are eyes for looking, and not eyes like an eyelet that you would put a thread through, if it's a reference to regular eyes, you have the four eyes, or the eight eyes of the cherubim's head, and then you have these other eyes within, all around these wheels, you know, one that goes this way and one that goes that way, but there are eyes all around it. You know, you think, well, that's weird. No, it's not really weird. I mean, we do that when we put cameras up. You know, game camps, people that really like to hunt and they like to get back into the woods, they get their expensive game cameras and they go stick them in the woods so the deer have to walk past them. And then they only shoot the deer that they like the best. You know, that just like the pioneers did, you know. I'll tell you, that's just so exciting. You go out there and you know exactly which deer you're going to bring back because you've been watching him for 5 days. Now, this is this way. These angels are just incredible. Anyway, going on to verse 19, and when the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them. So when they went that way, the wheels went that way, beside them somehow, and they're full of eyes. And when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. So up they went. And wherever the Spirit wanted to go, they went because that's where the Spirit went. Presumably, therefore, the angel was referred to as the Spirit. And the wheels were lifted up together with them. For the Spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. And when they went, when those went, these went. And when those stood, these stood. And when those were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. For the Spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. So it's a part of the cherubim are these wheels full of eyes, and their heads have eight eyes, and then wheels full of eyes. So it's no wonder that they're called watchers, because they have so many eyes that they can watch with. We'll understand all of that so much more as we get to it in due course, but it's truly amazing and fascinating to read about that. But there are other watchers we need to understand, and we're included in this next list shortly. We have government watchers, and aren't we glad? Let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Government watchers. We have another term for it, bureaucracy, where one official watches over other officials and other officials watch over them. It is described right here, and guess what? They've had bureaucracies from probably the get-go when they first started having human governments. Solomon making a comment on it, an analysis of wisdom about it. In chapter 5 and verse 8 of Ecclesiastes, if you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter. If you see it, don't worry, don't marvel, because high official watches over high official, and higher officials over them. So they'll get their comeuppance if the government is reasonably honest, or it doesn't make any difference, nothing's going to turn out good anyway, which is how, you know, it feels more like that as we get closer to the end of the age. But there you have high officials watching over higher officials, or being watched over by higher officials and more higher officials watching over them. There are watchers, therefore, within the government. And now we know that they can watch us a lot more than they ever used to, thanks to marvelous wonders of computer technology. But whatever the case, that's just what it is. There are natural, more familial watchers, too. Now let's go back to chapter 31 of Proverbs. Proverbs 31. And we'll take this one to the power of mom. Proverbs 31:27. 31 is about the virtuous wife, introduced in verse 10. Her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, and he will lack no will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. So this is the epitome of the virtuous woman. Now we go across the page to here we are, verse 27. Says in verse 26, she opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. She watches. She watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. She watches her kids. She watches what's going on. You ever try to get past mom? It didn't work, did it? You can often get past dad because dad's preoccupied with other things. But not mom. No, she watches, eagle eye, anything out of the ordinary, and she's on it in a minute. At least my mother was. So that's the classic case. But that's a parent watcher. Dads are to be watchers too. Good parents watch. And you know, we all try to be responsible watchers, whether we have little ones or whether just being fellow citizens and keep an eye on things. But then there are the ominous. You know, a healthy family has parents who watch, parental watchers. There are also demonic watchers. So let's go to 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5. Verses 8 and 9 of 1 Peter chapter 5. Here we go. The solution is given at beginning in verse 6. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, and he may exalt you in due time, casting all your cares on him, because he cares for you. Be sober, be vigilant, in verse 8, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And I wasn't looking for the devil in the woods when I was trying to get out of them. I was watching for a grizzly bear, but that would have been bad enough. Resist him steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. The devil walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. He is watching. We have to be vigilant. Vigilant means we have to be watchful, because we have an enemy who is watching us to get advantage of us and destroy us spiritually. So we have, therefore, demonic watchers. But the greatest watchers of all are next, Proverbs 15. Back to the Proverbs briefly, chapter 15. The greatest watchers of all, and this is the good news, more powerful than the devil by far. Chapter 15 and verse 3. The eyes of the eternal are in every place, keeping watch on the evil and the good. He's like Santa Claus. You know that silly little song that ascribes to Santa Claus the ability to know whether you've been bad or good? Well, that's sacrilegious in the ultimate sense of what that Santa Claus is, but that's the whole idea behind that anyway. No, God's eyes are in every place. He sees everything. He, the Father and Christ, keeping a watch on the evil and on the good. So we want to always, by the way we conduct ourselves, provide good things for God to see us doing. In Jeremiah 31, let's go back to the chapter that talks about the new covenant, Jeremiah 31, and see how Christ and the Father watch us from the comments that are made here. And I'm sure you could find other passages that talk about God's watchfulness. Chapter 31, verses 27 to 34. Of Jeremiah 31, verse 27. Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, that I will sow the house of Israel and the house of Judah with the seed of a man and the seed of beast. In other words, I'm going to give them back their land restored with wildlife and plants. And it shall come to pass that as I have watched over them to pluck up, to break down, to throw down, to destroy, and to afflict. And God did that. When they were disobedient, God did all those things, and he said that he would before he did it. And when they started misbehaving and refused to repent, then he started preparing to pluck them up, break them down, throw them down, destroy, and to afflict. That was the theme of Jeremiah. That's one of the themes that he had to carry in his prophecy. Well, even as I have done that, God says, so I will watch over them to build and to plant, says the Eternal, in those days, and they shall say no more, the fathers have eaten sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge, but everyone shall die for his own iniquity, and everyone who eats sour grapes, his teeth will be set on edge. And then he goes into the prophecy of the new covenant. Behold, the days are coming, says the Eternal, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, though I was a husband to them, says the Eternal. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people, and no more every man will teach his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, know the Lord, because they will all know me. From the least of them to the greatest of them, says the Eternal, and I will forgive their iniquity, and their sin I will remember no more. So God watched Israel carefully because he had to discipline them, to tear down, to pluck up, to destroy what they were doing. But he's going to turn that around now in the new covenant, where and in the new age, in the millennium, he will be watching how he can bless them, to plant them and establish them. So Christ and the Father are the greatest watchers. And we can take comfort in that. And we need to also take a clue from it. If Christ and the Father watch us, then we should be watching things too, the things they say to watch. Ezekiel 3:17. What do you know? As God's people, we are commissioned to be official watchers and make elk hunters uncomfortable as they're trying to get out of grizzly territory with their own hide. Ezekiel chapter 3, we'll begin at verse 16. Now it shall come to pass at the end of 7 days that the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Therefore hear a word from my mouth and give them warning from me. You give them warning from me. I have made you a watchman over the house of Israel. However, he goes on to say, and when I say to the wicked, in verse 18, you shall surely die, and you give him no warning nor speak to warn the wicked from his wicked ways, when I tell him he's going to die, if he does thus and such, and you don't warn him to save his life, that same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood I will require at your hand. That had to be motivating for Ezekiel. Yet if you warn the wicked, and he does not turn from his wickedness, but you did your part, you warned him, and he didn't turn from his wicked way, then he shall die in his iniquity, and you will have delivered your soul. You see, God's people, the church of God, and has always been the case, and it certainly is now, we're nearing closer and closer to the end of the age, we are to be watchmen of the house of Israel and, frankly, the rest of mankind. We're the ones that have to give the warning. There's trouble coming. Change your ways. And explain what those ways should be changed to. In chapter 33 of Ezekiel, this theme is carried on, because it's a strange thing about Ezekiel. We'll get to it in a minute here. But chapter 33, verse 7. You can read the whole chapter, because it talks very much about, especially the first half of it, very much about us being watchmen, or Ezekiel being a watchman. So you, son of man, in verse 7 it says, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Therefore you shall hear a word from my mouth and warn them for me. I have made you a watchman. And you think, wow, Ezekiel had a responsibility, a big responsibility. Yep. He did. But here's the odd thing. Ezekiel had no opportunity to be the watchman. He was stuck in Babylon. Remember? I told you. He was taken into captivity before Jerusalem fell. Approximately the same time Daniel and his three friends were taken into captivity. And he was a priest, Ezekiel was. He was moved about 60 or 70 miles south down the Euphrates River near the river Chebar. South of Babylon, over 1,000 traveling miles to get back to the promised land, and he never got back. He had no chance or opportunity to be the watchman that God says that he is. So where does that put the Church of God today? We're doing the work Ezekiel had to do. This was a prophecy that would be fulfilled by the church. It was fulfilled by the church during the days of the apostles. God's church is fulfilling that, or is supposed to be fulfilling that today. We understood this a few decades ago. Mr. Armstrong often talked about this important part. There is a warning element to the gospel of the kingdom of God. The gospel is fantastic. It's wonderful. But it is made for those who want to overcome. Who want to be like Christ is. It's not made for those who want to do their own thing. See, that's where the warning edge comes into it. It's vital to round out the gospel of God's kingdom. So you see, we as the Church of God in this era have the responsibility to watch world events. We have a responsibility to preach and publish the gospel, primarily the good news of the kingdom of God, but also the warning message, repent and believe. The gospel. There's the warning tone that's in that aspect of it. Let's go back to Matthew 25 now. Sorry if I've given you Bible burn on your thumbs, spinning back and forth and back and forth from one place to another, but keeps you alert. It keeps your thumbs alert, at least. Matthew 25, verse 13. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. We have to watch because we don't know when Christ is going to return specifically. We know the harbingers of his coming. We've been watching those for 2,000 years, and the intensity has grown and grown and grown and grown and grown. But we still don't know specifically when Christ will return. Therefore, we have to be preparing for it constantly, always vigilant. Doesn't some military force have that as their symbol, always vigilant, or something like that? It is our duty to be always vigilant, our duty to watch world events, our duty to preach and publish the full gospel of God's kingdom. We need to watch personally. As we see there, watch you therefore, for you neither know the day or the hour the Son of Man is coming. We need to do that at a personal level, brethren. Because that's going to come out in conversation naturally if we've internalized it. In Mark 13, let's go over to the book of Mark. Mark 13, verse 33. Hold it. I'm looking at Mark 14. No wonder it doesn't make sense. Let me go to Mark 13. And you will be hated by all by all nations. In some places it says it adds the word nations in. You'll be hated by all for my name's sake. But he who endures to the end, the same shall be saved. That's verse 13. And then down in verse 33, the day and the hour knows no man, in verse 32, not even the angels in heaven. In other words, that's reserved to the Father alone. Christ doesn't even know the day or the hour that he's going to return, but the Father will. Take heed, watch, and pray, for you do not know when the time is. So we have to be watchful of the end time and the events that are transpiring and happening. In Matthew chapter 24, verses 42 to 44, turn to Matthew 24, verses 42 to 44. It says the same similar thing. Watch therefore, for you do not know the hour that your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known the hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming in an hour that you do not think. You know, I kind of felt like I needed to be ready as I was hiking out of those elk woods. No, bear woods. There was grizzly woods. It wasn't elk woods. I had to be ready in case there was a grizzly bear. You know, I knew enough about, knew enough then and even more now of grizzly bear anatomy and how long their claws are and big teeth and all that kind of thing. And the nasty dispositions. They just really are cantankerous bears. So don't trust grizzly bears. And try to get your elk out in one piece instead of having to go back and retrieve parts of it. In Luke 21 was where we'll conclude. Luke 21. Well, actually, we won't. We're going to go to Isaiah 52, but I'll read that part to you. Luke 21, verses 34 to 36. Luke 21, verses 34 to 36 stresses the importance of watching. But take heed to yourself, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing and drunkenness and the cares of this life. And they can do that. We can think, well, we need to sort of blend in, and we need to fit in. We need to have a good time. I deserve it. Be careful. Don't think that. Beware. Be aware. Don't drop your spiritual guard for an instant. Not for an instant. For it will come as a snare to all those who dwell on the face of the earth. In verse 35, come unexpectedly. Watch, therefore, verse 36, and pray always that you be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and stand before the Son of Man. Watch, watch, watch. We are all watchers. And we have to watch out for each other. We have to watch out for ourselves and our own attitudes. And we're going to conclude with Isaiah 52. Isaiah 52, starting in verse 7 and through verse 10. Okay, here it is. You know this section. It's really a beautiful section of Isaiah. How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who proclaims peace. That's marvelous. It's much better than going into the mountains with a grizzly bear tracking you out of them. How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who proclaims peace, who brings glad tidings of good things, who proclaims salvation, who says to Zion, meaning God, your God reigns. Your watchmen shall lift up their voices. Your watchmen will lift up their voices. We have the duty, brethren, collectively as God's church, to be the watchmen of this age. That is our responsibility, and all the elements of the faithful part of the church of God have to do that, have to be active in doing that. Your watchmen shall lift up their voices, and with their voices they will sing together, for they will see eye to eye when the Lord brings back Zion. They will see eye to eye. But they have to be watchmen. Break forth into joy. Sing together, you waste places of Jerusalem. For the Lord has comforted his people. He has redeemed Jerusalem. The Eternal has made bare his holy arm in the eyes of all the nations. When you bear the holy arm, you know, you're bearing the arm for a war, and that's going to take place. And the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of God. So you have the wars of the end of this age, but as God's plan unfolds in Revelation, we will watch all this happen because we will have a direct hand in the doing of it. we will see the time when we bring salvation to all who desire it.